case?
Case numbers 21-5017, 18, and 19, M. Long versus Lester Piercy Jr. et al. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Cowan, you may proceed for the appellant.
You may proceed.
May it please the court. I'd like to start off with talking about the standard of review for this. In the appellee's brief, they said that this court would have to uphold the bankruptcy court's findings of fact, unless clearly erroneous. But I think under this court's decision, and in Re D'Antoni in 2012, the court said that the grant of summary judgment and the applicability of issue preclusion, which is what we're here about today, are both reviewed de novo. So I would assert that since this case has only been through the summary judgment phase, the bankruptcy court's grant of summary judgment and the her application of collateral estoppel will be reviewed de novo. And in the same case, in Re D'Antoni, 2012, the bankruptcy appellate panel in this case held that when you consider embezzlement as a reason to block a discharge of bankruptcy defendants, and you consider the underlying state court tort of conversion, that those two are very dissimilar. And since one you have to prove fraud in, and in state courts you don't have to prove fraud in to get conversion under Tennessee law, that those can't be applied to issue to apply issue preclusion. So that's what the bankruptcy court did. In the underlying state court action, there was a partnership, three of these partners.
Is there a state of mind for Tennessee conversion?
There is not.
It's just, you could just be holding somebody's property and it would be conversion, unlawfully or whatever it would be.
Yes, Your Honor. In my principal brief, I cited a case from 2013, I believe, from the court of, 2012, from the Court of Appeals. And just a quote from that case, a wrongful intent on the part of the defendant is not an element of conversion and therefore need not be proved. So, and we didn't prove it. In state court, we could have gone for punitive damages where we could have said it was fraudulently converted, and we could have tried for punitive damages. We did not do that. So fraud was not even.
So there is a fraudulent conversion? I mean, is it just a fraud with a conversion kind of element to it? Or if you had, in Tennessee, like you would plead a fraud and then, and a separate count for conversion? Or is there a fraudulent conversion, I guess?
I would have called it fraudulent conversion, but that's what it is. If you're seeking punitive damages under Hodges v. Toof in Tennessee, you'd have to also prove, on top of the conversion, you'd have to prove a fraudulent intent. And if you could do that by clear and convincing evidence, you can get punitive damages.
Didn't you argue to the bankruptcy court that the state court did decide the fraud issue?
Yes. She initially started out by saying, hey, this is res judicata. This is claim preclusion. And because you didn't raise it in the court, in state court, because you didn't raise the fraud issue, then you can't even bring it in the bankruptcy court. So she said claim preclusion.
I understand that, but that's different. I thought you said the state court in front of her that they did decide the fraud issue, which is different than I brought the fraud issue.
Yes, and candidly, I didn't appreciate the distinction at that time, but that's what I said. And I said, Your Honor, what this case was about was they took this property, they did it knowingly.
Why would we allow you to do one thing in front of the bankruptcy court and a different thing in front of the district court and us?
Well, I think for judicial estoppel to apply, you have to be successful in your bringing of that. But and obviously I was not successful or I would not be here today. But, you know, assume that was raised. Long won the case. Long was awarded every penny he asked for that conversion. So to apply issue preclusion against Long he would have, one, it had to be necessary to the case, which it was not. Okay, but two, he would have had to lose that issue. He did not. He was awarded every penny he asked for that conversion.
Why did the state court chancellor didn't clarify on what basis he was awarding Long the money, though, did he?
He did not. And I don't think the bankruptcy court appreciated basically the two elements of damages. See, this partnership, this was a large rock quarry. There's a bunch of rock left there by the time we got to trial. So I asked for the conversion of the profits that had been made to date up to that point. And I said, and also, these partners had a contract. He's entitled to his expectation damages for the rest of this rock that's out there. They have padlocked him off the property. They're not sending him a dime. They're not sending him a dime of what they argue is the proper calculation. They're not sending a dime of what he argued was the proper calculation. So they didn't send him anything, period. So I said, that shows your intent, that they're not trying to even operate in good faith. So I brought that up in the brief to the bankruptcy court and to this court. So for both of these, I mean, he never got a penny after those two meager checks that they started out with. So I said, if the court's requiring me to show fraud in the state court, I think I've done that, but it's not required.
And I gather, of course, the issue of whether a debt is dischargeable or not is not an issue that would ever be tried in a state court. That's a thing.
Exactly, and that's a very important point. She was holding me to the standard that I would have had to anticipate a dischargeability issue in the state court money judgment proceeding, and that's solely a federal court issue. And there's, you know, I cited case law to the court after that. And she came back after she asked us to brief res judicata and said, yeah, you're right, claim preclusion does not apply.
She was asking you about res judicata.
Yes.
Claim preclusion.
No, you're correct in the first instance. She asked us about res judicata. And
well, claim res judicata, claim preclusion, not collateral estoppel issue preclusion.
Yes.
In other words, so she thought you should have brought, initially was questioning whether you should have brought a fraud claim, whether you could have brought and should have brought a fraud claim in state court. And your argument in response was, I did. to save your case, I
yes,
take it, right?
Yes.
Okay, I got
and you're exactly correct.
But she was but that's incorrect, right? You're not res judicata for what reason Judge Gilman is saying. You're not, okay, but you can be issue precluded, not claim precluded, right?
Yes, that's exactly correct. And in fact, in his brief, he brought back and said, hey, we're not arguing issue preclusion because that's beyond the scope of what the court asked for. But then she came back and said, oh, yeah, but in the Sixth Circuit, res judicata includes claim preclusion and issue preclusion. So tried to say we should have told her about both at that time. She came back at that in a footnote in her opinion. So, but the correct law is, as you stated, claim preclusion does not apply because this is a federal issue and you can't litigate the bankruptcy issues down in Chancery Court and state court. Dischargeability issues. So we went on at that point and said, okay, does issue preclusion apply? And that's what's before this court. Does issue preclusion apply? And this court, like I said, in D'Antoni came back and said no, because this was a Michigan case, but it said no in 2012, the bankruptcy panel did, because the issue of state court conversion and the issue of embezzlement in a bankruptcy proceeding are just too different. And under Tennessee law, which is what this court has to look to apply issue preclusion, you have to do it to the same extent the state court would. And in state court, the issues have to be identical, not merely similar. And not only are they not identical, but there's a huge difference in that you have to prove state of mind of fraud in a bankruptcy court case to block discharge.
Also, on the other sort of prong of dischargeability is on the fraud or defalcation, she was saying there's what, no fiduciary relationship pre-existing.
Yes. And the case law is pretty clear in this circuit. There has to be, for defalcation in a fiduciary capacity, there has to be an express or technical trust. And a technical trust is just a passive trust. In other words, money comes in and the trustee's only duty is to pass it on to the other person who's supposed to get it. Not supposed to invest it, not supposed to do anything else with it, just to pass it on to the person who's supposed to get it. And that's exactly what this partnership was. One of the Piercy defendants, the mother, was supposed, the bookkeeper, supposed to get in the money.
Governed by the Uniform Partnership, whatever Uniform Partnership Act.
Revised.
Okay.
Partnership Act, yes.
And it provides for a fiduciary relationship?
It does, Your Honor, and I have a quote in here on the second part of my brief, and it's very short, but I'd just like to say a partner has a fiduciary responsibility, quote, to account to the partnership and hold as trustee for it any property, profit, or benefit derived by the partner in the conduct of the partnership business or derived from a use by the partner of partnership property, including appropriation of a partnership opportunity. So in other words, each partner, as they should be, are both fiduciaries to each other and trustees for each other of that property that comes into their hands.
Why did the bankruptcy court not recognize that?
I don't know. But I can tell you that a technical trust is not a term you run into every day. Technical trust just is the dry trust, and that's from Brian Garner's, you know, most recent Black's Law Dictionary. It's property that comes in, and your only duty as trustee is to pass it on to the person who's supposed to get it. So that would be exactly what this partnership relationship is.
So you think the bankruptcy court and the district court have both erred here?
Yes. Yes.
You want us to straighten it out for you?
That'd be wonderful.
Okay.
And I think the and I didn't find it in time for my initial brief, but the D'Antoni, or however it's pronounced, case in 2012 of this bankruptcy appellate panel is just on all fours with this case. They say, hey, you know, in embezzlement, you have to prove the fraud element, state of mind, and conversion. And under Michigan law, and same with Tennessee, you don't. You just prove that they took the property and it was away from its rightful owner.
I mean, I gather that even if we reverse and send it back to say you're not precluded, you know, there's no issue preclusion, you, of course, hadn't won yet. You still have to now prove back in the district court, the bankruptcy court, that there was fraud or there was an intent to defraud, right?
And I think we can do that. We just never had the chance. We were... He actually filed a motion to dismiss, not a motion for summary judgment, but she converted it under the rules, so we had an opportunity to both apply additional material to her to let her consider it, but it was a summary judgment, so we've never had the chance to even get in front of a court and say, this is what you did wrong to us. You padlocked us off the property and kept all our money, not part of it, all of it. So that's why it's embezzlement and breach of a fiduciary duty, and that's why we should have our money back. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
I think I've reserved a couple, 3 minutes.
You did.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Ryan Gerard with the Knoxville Bar. I'm representing the appellees in this case, Lester Dan Piercy, Dolores J. Piercy, and Joseph Shane Piercy. And as my colleague pointed out, this is kind of a simple fact pattern as far as this case goes because it was resolved on initially a motion to dismiss was converted to a summary judgment motion. But I do not agree that this matter's never been before a court. This matter has been before a court before, and that's the issue. In February the 7th of 2012, the appellant had an opportunity, filed a complaint in the Tennessee State Court. He filed an action against all the appellees in this matter, and it was a matter that was styled Long versus Goins Hollow Quarry, and he filed a breach of contract action. He even had an opportunity to amend his complaint. He never added any allegations of fraud or theft. It was a simple breach of contract case. Now this case went.
Talk about withholding of funds, right?
Your Honor, there was the main dispute in that case was whether or not the profits were properly calculated. Specifically, this court went to trial.
I'm confused.
Sorry, Your Honor.
It doesn't matter what he didn't bring, right? The only thing that matters for issue preclusion is what they brought and what was adjudicated. So if you're saying they didn't bring a fraud claim, I suppose his response would be, right, I didn't bring a fraud claim, therefore it wasn't adjudicated, therefore I can adjudicate it in bankruptcy court.
Well, Your Honor, we kind of go back and forth as far as what the appellant has argued is what he's presented before the bankruptcy court. He said he did argue it. Now he's saying that he hasn't.
Well, it's the records. Like there was some confusion about whether res judicata applied, whether it was just collateral estoppel. But I mean, it doesn't change. None of that changes what actually happened, which is he brought a breach of contract and a conversion claim, and the question is, was some element of the fraud that you would have in bankruptcy court adjudicated in state court?
And Your Honor, the answer to that is yes, it was. He was able to put on all of his proof in the state court. He was able to put on all of his damages. And the only issue that the judge found that was worthy...
The state court never even mentioned fraud, and it has to be actually and necessarily decided under Mazengill, the Tennessee case.
That's correct, Your Honor, but the point is that he did hear that proof, and he did not find that there was any fraud. He didn't put it in his
order. He didn't find there wasn't fraud either. So
Your Honor,
nothing to preclude us.
Your Honor, the only issue he found was that the issue of the case was whether or not there was any lost profits. The appellant simply failed at the state court level based on the evidence that we have in front of us and the trial court's judgment.
I thought they got a judgment in their favor.
They did get a judgment in their favor, but they didn't get it based on fraud. They got it based off of contract, and now they have to rely on that in the bankruptcy.
Usually when you rule on it, you rule, okay, there's breach of contract, there's this, there's not this. There wasn't anything, there's not this, and fraud isn't an element of breach of contract or conversion.
Certainly, Your Honor, if we could go back and we could clarify the original trial court judge's decision to add that in, we would attempt to. But the judge was presented with all the facts and the allegation.
But could you imagine the ramifications if we start holding that issue preclusion exists when the state court doesn't even speak to it?
Your Honor, I could imagine it if it's a different set of circumstances where a matter has not been taken all the way to trial or a matter has not been fully litigated. Certainly the cases stand against that. The concern that I have from a publicly policy standpoint, since you brought that up, is the reverse of that. From a debtor bankruptcy standpoint, the whole point of bankruptcy is to get a fresh start.
Well, why not go back to the state court when you don't get a resolution on an issue and say, can you give us a ruling on that? That's what usually is done. If a court messes up, the onus is on the parties to clarify it. And if they don't, there's no preclusive effect if we can't see it clearly. That seems pretty reasonable.
And certainly, Your Honor, the appellant had that. Both sides did have the opportunity to do that. The appellant had that opportunity to do that. But he waited to bring this issue up until the bankruptcy was filed, which was filed by all the defendants on July 24th, 2018. The judgment was rendered on September the 19th, 2013, and was final 30 days later. So we're talking...
But he had won in state court. I mean, so he didn't care what theory. He wanted dollars, and he got dollars. It seems like the burden would be on your clients to say, hey, look, would you rule that there was no fraud here?
And, Your Honor, he didn't bother with it because he felt like he had gotten a ruling in his favor. The issue is now we go to bankruptcy court and he changes his mind.
Oh, it's because you were seeking to discharge it.
but that's the point of issue preclusion and res judicata. That is the entire point of this. It is designed to not waste the court's time relitigating issues that
have been. What I'm struggling with is if we don't have a judgment on the issue, how do we give it preclusive effect?
I think you can give it preclusive effect, Your Honor, because he did present all of his facts, all of his proof, all of these issues. These issues were litigated by the Chancellor. The Chancellor just didn't buy any of them because the only issue that he saw was dealing with this contract issue and what is the definition of profits under the agreement.
Well, he didn't seek punitive damages, he just said, hey, you've converted some money that's due me.
But that's the point, Your Honor. The conversion was before the Chancellor, and the Chancellor
could
have made
But conversion doesn't require any proof of intent to defraud.
Well, I don't know that the judge didn't even find there was conversion. He just found that the profits were not properly calculated. And that kind of gets us to the case that I've cited in my brief, which is the In re Bucci case, found at 493 F period 3D 635 by this court in 2007, where we're talking about the difference in findings between an express or a technical finding, and this court has a narrow definition of what is required for defalcation under 11 U.S.C. 523. And the fact is that the judge heard all of these arguments, and all that the trial judge found was that somebody failed to meet an obligation under their common law obligation, which in this case was a partnership agreement. And kind of bringing that back around.
Wait, Common law is not the same as the partnership law, the Tennessee Partnership Act.
Well, I understood that, Your Honor. What I'm sort of getting at is why the Bucci case is on point with this, is that case dealt with somebody who had merely failed to meet an obligation, and that was the situation we had here. The chancellor found that the appellees in this case didn't properly apportion the profits as they were required to under the Partnership Act. He didn't. This was an error.
Was a breach of contract finding.
It's a breach of contract finding.
That's all we got is a breach of contract finding.
No, Your Honor. I think what we've got is they put on their proof, and that's all that the judge was able to find was that it's a breach of contract. He didn't specifically make findings that, well, the Piercy's took this money. He didn't say. I mean, I know my client likes to put in his pleadings that there was a padlock that was placed and his client was not able to go on the premises. Chancellor Fogarty never found that. Chancellor Fogarty just found there was a partnership agreement and it was breached. But all these facts were presented.
Is there a claim for punitive damages in the complaint?
I don't remember, Your Honor.
I mean, if they made a claim for punitive damages, then I would say, okay, well, then they were making a claim that would, they thought would entitle them to punitive damages, which would probably be a fraud. But if there is no claim for punitive damages, I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen it. But I looked at it, you know. But I've forgotten. But I don't know. I mean, that seems to me. It seems to me they brought what was essentially a breach of contract case. They tried a breach of contract case. You're saying they had other proof. They had other proof that your clients were bad actors, let's say. But it doesn't seem consequential to the whatever the state court judgment was.
Your Honor, obviously the judge didn't give that any merit in his decision. That would be my argument.
Well, didn't give it any merit or didn't think it was relevant to a breach of contract finding. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that comes in at trial that doesn't necessarily, the judge doesn't go through at the end and say, oh, by the way, I found all of these things credible, these things not. He just says, hey, you're entitled to the money.
Correct. But the problem is, Your Honor, we can't go back. We can't bring Chancellor Fogarty in here and depose him and sort of get what he was getting.
I agree with that, but we're here to talk about issue preclusion, and so if we don't have that, then how can we say they're issue precluded on anything?
Well, we can say that, Your Honor, because I do remember you asked if they asked for punitive damage in the complaint. I honestly don't recall that. I would just refer back to the record as to whether they asked for that or not. But I do remember they did allege that they were padlocked off the premises, they were prevented from going on the business, they were not given
in support of breach of contract and conversion?
I would say it would be in support of conversion, and the judge simply didn't find that argument convincing.
Well, but we just don't know because the judge didn't make, the chancellor didn't make that clear. I mean, I assume if he thought there was conversion, you have to look at, well, to know whether there's conversion, you have to look at the contract between the parties to decide what money might have been withheld.
And we'd have to crawl into the judge's head. I mean, certainly it would be easier if he had
You're asking us to do that. Fraud isn't an element of conversion, is it?
Your Honor, well, at what level? Are we talking state or are we talking
state?
Can you ask that question one more time so make sure I've got it clear?
Is fraud an element of conversion under Tennessee state law?
Well, your friend said that there was wrongful intent conversion or fraudulent conversion, but
correct.
It could be non-fraudulent conversion.
You could have a non-fraudulent
holding property.
Correct. Correct.
Was the remedy here different for the breach of contract and the conversion?
Your Honor, the remedy
would the number in the judgment have been different?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I was not the trial attorney for the underlying case. I didn't get involved in it until the bankruptcy was filed.
Let me ask you this, sir. Do you have any dispute with the legal proposition that partners have a fiduciary relationship to each other under Tennessee partnership?
I don't have a dispute with that. But sort of circling back around, I believe I was attempting to answer a public policy argument from you, and the public policy answer I believe you asked was, what if we open the door to letting these cases be decided by issue preclusion? The countervailing argument I say to that, Your Honor, is how do we handle a case where somebody has filed a lawsuit, they've taken it all the way to trial, they've gone all the way through discovery, they've gotten a judgment, and then now we go to bankruptcy court and they say, wait. Now that I'm reading 11 U.S.C. 523, I'm going to change my mind now in terms of the claims that I can bring. Now I'm going to bring an adversary action for fraud.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair point. I think the flip side is if you thought he was bringing a fraud claim before, you had an obligation to get the judgment clarified so that it would have preclusive effect. I mean, they're both, look, your argument's a good argument, but my point is that it seems to me we would prefer to operate in clarity, and you're asking us to dive in and read the judge's mind.
Well, I'm not asking you to read the judge's mind. I'm asking you to give full effect to the legal opinion, which is the judge was presented all these facts. You can go and you can look at the complaint. You can look at the allegations that the appellant made originally where he was padlocked off the property, money was withheld. Can only assume that those facts were put in front of the judge. We don't have the trial transcript.
The chancellor did not say, I find no fraud.
Correct, but we don't know why the chancellor didn't do that. The chancellor did.
I don't either.
The chancellor could have simply not found it necessary, and certainly by operation of Tennessee law, the judgment was final 30 days after it was filed. So there was no way to go back. It would be a reach to try to go back and clarify with Chancellor Fogarty what his original decision was or try to get a revised judgment at this point. It was just simply beyond that by the time I got involved. At this point, what we have is the bankruptcy court, which certainly can litigate these matters, but the bankruptcy court decided that in order to give full faith and credit to this state court decision, issue preclusion applied, and that there was simply no basis in the claim that was filed by the appellants for fraud or for anything that would be non-dischargeable. I've got about a minute 30 left, Your Honors. I think at this point we've kind of exhaustively discussed this. Do you have any further questions for me?
Nothing further. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you for your time, Your Honors.
As I stated earlier, I am confident that we didn't ask for punitive damages in that case. That would have brought on a whole new level of burden of proof on everything we did, and I did not ask for that.
So it's not in your complaint? There's no prayer for relief in the complaint?
Correct. In fact, the word fraud is not in the complaint.
Why isn't your friend right, which is at times you're claiming you did bring fraud there, at times you're not. Now you're in the bankruptcy court. You figure out you can't get you can't get the money unless there's fraud. So now you're claiming fraud.
Yeah. Okay. That's when fraud becomes relevant, when you're in the bankruptcy context.
Well, I don't know. If, as Judge Nalbandian pointed out, if you cared that much in state court, you could have brought a fraud claim and got punitives.
Could have.
So, I mean, it seems though, my biggest problem is you seem to be arguing to the district court or the bankruptcy court at one point you're bringing fraud, then you seem that you did, then you're arguing you didn't, and we're left just kind of, you're going both ways.
In the state court, when we had the Chancery Court action, fraud was not mentioned. Punitive damages were not mentioned. The chancellor's opinion.
Then did he misrepresent it to the bankruptcy judge?
When we got into and you have to raise that in the bankruptcy court when she says, hey, did you raise fraud down there? And I said, well, and I candidly said, those words are not in the complaint. Those words are not in Chancellor Forgett's opinion. I said, but we presented our facts down there that would support a finding of fraud by this court in the context of a dischargeability action. I said, we didn't hide those facts down there. We brought them. We told the court about being padlocked off the property, about them threatening to call the police on us if we showed up, about them not paying us a penny, about them diverting, the word diverting is in my complaint, state court complaint, about them diverting my client's funds to the other three. So I said, those facts are there. But I didn't say that the words fraud were in there because they weren't. I couldn't make that up. But she felt like they had to be at the time from the tenor of her questions. So that's why it seems to flip back and forth, but I tried to be honest with the court at all times. I said, those words are not in there, but our facts were in there. I said, quote, that's what the case was about, them taking our money. That's the way I presented that to the bankruptcy court. Now, he says, why didn't you bring a claim for conversion? Had Chancellor Fogarty said, you know, I'm going to award you all this money based on contract. I'm not going to award you a penny for conversion. I'm going to dismiss conversion. The result would be the same here today. Conversion and embezzlement are too different to allow one to have preclusive effect.
Were the damages different on the conversion and the breach of contract?
No.
It was the same.
It'd be the same to the penny. The same to the penny. That's why I didn't care in state court. We didn't care. We got the money judgment. It wasn't important to us to have to prove fraud. We didn't have to. We didn't have to prove state of mind. And you...
Your time is up.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you. The case will be submitted. I think the remaining case is on the briefs, so we'll be in recess.
This honorable court is now adjourned.